If you would stand, we're going to look at a passage in Isaiah, and let's read it together. It's a familiar text. The Spirit of
the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good tidings to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit, that they may be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. They shall build up the ancient ruins. They shall raise up the former devastations. They shall repair the ruined cities, the devastations of many generations.
Please be seated.
This is as I mentioned, a very familiar text. Jesus used this in his first sermon in Nazareth. We're all familiar with it. But the original text comes out of the exilic community coming back to Zion, back to Jerusalem from painful exile. And as I reflect on this, this looks to me like a great vision talk, doesn't it? I mean, if you can see the elements of our vision statement in there, and the whole idea of transformed lives and the liberation, the freedom, the ashes to joy, you have the section on developing oaks of righteousness. Sounds like world changers to me, people who will be pillars, who will stand. And then the last verse, and this is verse 4, when we think about the Israelites, they were going back to a devastated place, and they were going to have to literally rebuild Jerusalem and the cities. For our mission, our purpose, as we think about the university world, and this is the theme of what I want to focus on today, is that first line, they shall build up the ancient ruins, and this devastation, in some ways, which has gone on for generations. In front of you, you have a quiz. There's two sides to the quiz. I want you to turn to the back side, which starts with Harvard, other schools. In your own free time, you can do the Wisconsin schools. They sort of added that as a bonus. But we're going to take about 5 minutes. There's no grading here. We're not going to collect these. But there are pencils or pens available. You already have them? Yeah, you all have them. Okay. So what you're going to do is, you know how this gimmick works, right? You take the A, B columns on the right and you fill them in. So I'm going to be quiet. Any questions before you do that? You're going to be guessing on a lot of these, okay? So don't feel stupid. Everybody's guessing a lot, but you might be able to figure out a few of them, all right? So look up when you're done. I have prizes, by the way, so...
Just guess.
Okay, 20 seconds and counting. This is going to be honor code, too. I'm not going to collect these. All right, ready? Here's the answers. Harvard is K. USC is C. Gotta love those Fighting Methodists. Duke is H. Oberlin is D.
D
as in David. Cornell is F. Some of these were really impossible.
Thank you.
U of Chicago, I think that's the J. I can't read my own writing.
University of Illinois.
Chicago is A. The Baptist got in the University of Chicago, if you knew that one. Northwestern is I.
Illinois was J.
Chicago was A. Northwestern was I. Emory was L. I gave you the Georgia thing. I thought I'd throw that in. Boston University is B. University of Virginia is E. And Syracuse is G. All right. Now, I want you to add up the correct scores that you got. Okay, this is going to be the moment of prizes. All right, there are 12 of these. Did anybody get 12? 11. 10. 9. 8. This is encouraging, isn't it? 7. 7. 7. I told you should come to chapel. All right. Now, I have two prizes. The first prize is called Nihilist Chewing Gum, and it says, we don't believe in flavor, so that's one option. Or there's a 2003 Urbana Salvation Army kazoo. So which one do you want? The Nihilist gum or the kazoo?
Kazoo.
You want the kazoo? All right. So do we have? We have six. Tom, okay, you get the Nihilist gum. All right, well, either guys are very good guessers or you know something about higher education in a way. Let's talk just for a minute. Were there any surprises? Well, any comments, reactions to this? As you now you know the answers.
We had to teach him.
Can we stipulate that he can't use that at work?
I think people in that back part of the building would appreciate that. Responses or reactions to, now we'll get serious for the moment. As you look at these answers, are there anything that jump out at you kind of surprising? I hope a lot does. I mean, well, anything in particular?
University of Illinois. The private schools, you kind of know they have some way back history, but if you're a state school...
Until 1905, the president at University of Michigan was talking about it being a school. He taught the class in moral philosophy, which was the capstone senior course, and it being a Christian school. It's not that long ago. It's a century ago. It's not just Illinois. It's most of these public schools would have considered themselves to be Christian in a broader sense. Other comments. Duke in 1924, this was the bylaws. If you go on campus now, there's a big plaque right outside the big cathedral there. It says the same thing about this is our purpose, this is what we do. I love the Fighting Methodists from USC. That's probably my favorite. It's an oxymoron. Any other comments?
It's interesting that a professor was fired for saying that the Bible contained myths and errors. It seems to be flip-flopped
now. We're going to get to the current survey that I've got for you on the statistics, and you're almost questioned if you're the other way now. How on that question of myths and fables, how much that has flipped completely. Yeah, Boston, you have, with Boston U, is a Methodist school, is that right? Boston College Catholic, Boston U is, and Northwestern is a Methodist school. You may not know that. The other schools, let me just give you, I mean, Yale was started by Congregationalists, Princeton by Presbyterians, Brown by Baptists, UPenn by Presbyterians, Rutgers by Reformed, Columbia by Anglicans, and on and on. I've got a whole list here. Let me read you a quote from Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson was kind of an ironic prophet for his day. He wrote, "The ambition and the tyranny of the Presbyterians would tolerate no rival if they had power. Systematical and grasping at the ascendancy over all denominations, they aim, like the Jesuits," so he picks out these two groups because they had solid worldviews, "at engrossing the education of this country. They yearn to exterminate all heretics to the Calvinistic creed," end quote. Thomas Jefferson, our third president. Jefferson at the time was very much in the minority voice as he penned those words, but of course today he is, like I say, the prophet who has been honored, and things have flipped completely. I recently read a book called The Decline of the Secular University, and this is no longer even a question of whether the university is secularized, and I'm not going to bemoan the point, but getting back to the point made over here, a recent survey done by a professor from Harvard and George Mason said that if you include all faculty from all religious schools and everything, 17% of the faculty would say that they considered themselves born again. But when you go to the so-called elite schools, that drops to 1%. When you look at how many, let's see, half of the faculty believe that the Bible is a book of fables and legends. But when you look at the elite schools, that's 75%. So what would have gotten you fired at Boston University a century ago, now you're definitely in the mainstream. Well, what happened? That would take hours and hours and hours. And if you're interested, I've got a few books that I would be glad to share with you. But let me give you just a few factors in a very quick fashion. Most of the schools, the religious schools, private schools, were denominational schools. And what happened to all these denominational schools, whether Protestant or Catholic, over time, is they wanted to draw a broader range of faculty and of donors. So they tried to broaden their missions. In doing so, they tended to water down their distinctiveness. Another factor in the 19th century was the perceived breach between science and religion. And, you know, as the German sort of model of empiricism came in, that is, you can only believe what you can prove came in, then, of course, what did that do to things like religion and philosophy and arts? They all got kind of pushed out a bit. And in the late 19th century, religion was moved, with the permission, I might add, as you read the histories of many Christians, from the center of the university to the periphery in terms of co-curricular activities. So you began to see denominational centers with the Lutherans and the Catholics and the Methodists about that time. Dwight Moody was involved with the YMCA movement. That began to happen. And if you look at, before InterVarsity came along, there was a group called the Student Volunteer Movement in the 1880s. And just at the time that the university was becoming more secular, what happened was being rearranged. It was a two-step process. Religion was pushed to the outside as co-curricular, and then, of course, it began to fall off. And then this gap existed, and then groups like the Student Volunteer Movement came in. Of course, there's the factor of the government, which began to offer more and more money to colleges and universities, particularly private ones, and that encouraged them to become more bland in their distinctiveness. But I think, as I look at all of these factors, I think it was the secularization of the culture, that we as a Christian church, historic church I'm speaking of now, we are responsible, I think, for losing university. So I think we can blame the government, we can blame everything external, and those were all factors. I don't mean to diminish them. But the university world at one point was ours, and it no longer is in the same way that it once was. So what do we do? Do we... as we read Isaiah 61 about rebuilding the ancient ruins that have gone through devastation for generations, what do we do? Well, as we focus on our vision statement about renewing campuses, this is probably the one phrase that I get the most questions on. People go, what in the world does that mean? I mean, I can get the transforming students and faculty, and I can get developing world changers, but what do you mean? And it's in there because I think it's core to what we believe we're about. We're about the university world. Often talk about the pond as an illustration. I'm not going to use that one again today. But the image here is, how do we get back in the game, so to speak? And actually, I don't think we ever left the game, but how do we increase our play in that game? The first option is to do what a lot of Christians do, is we'll start new schools. You know, we'll just write these schools off, and we'll just start. And I taught for 16 years at one of those schools, and it was a great school. So I don't have anything to disparage about it. But the reality is that only about 3% of the high school kids coming out of evangelical churches will go to those schools. That's just the Christian kids. 97% will go to the schools that we serve. So I don't agree with a radio evangelist who about a decade ago just basically said, don't send your kids to any of these schools. Only send to the secular, more secular schools. Now, the second option is for us to be a significant player at established schools. That is, to find ways to influence. And as we continue to think about this, I think we're on kind of a journey defining what exactly this means. There's no single silver bullet, but I think there's a portfolio of actions. I was really encouraged as I was preparing for staff conference, and it didn't end up being in my talk just because of time, but at Emory University, the staff there have done such a good job at integrating and working with the administration. The week I was there, the president of the university was going to speak at the chapter. Isn't that cool? 2 months later, the chaplain's office and our staff, university staff, were co-sponsoring bringing Jimmy Carter to campus and talking about being a Christian statesman in the 21st century. I mean, isn't that cool? Our faculty sponsor there is a fellow, and I had to take him out of the talk. I really regret to do it. But he's a Japanese-American guy who became a Christian at the University of Chicago, largely via university there. And he's now also the vice provost. He's in his late 30s. This guy is going to be something special. And hopefully he'll help us start a faculty chapter there. But the point is that we are trying to work with the university. So I think another way in which we renew campuses is through IVP books. And some of that is subtle. You go to the library and you find, you know, all the reference books we do, those find themselves into amazing libraries. It's not just seminaries and churches. A lot of those reference books go great places. And when you look at books on economics and arts and specific disciplines, those are helping to shape professors' minds. I think of our alumni program, and I think of the alumni that are going out into the university, in the academy, as part of their calling. There are times when we take a hard stand vis-a-vis the university in order to help the university, such as when we filed suit against the University of Wisconsin last year. I think, you know, we did that. I think as I look at our staff and I look at on the campus and I look here, it was important that we did that. It was important that we say, no, we're not going to be further marginalized out on the edge. We belong here. Our voice is here. But I think if I had to pick one area where the most significant impact that we have on the campus today is through our faculty ministries. And I remember when I was trying to come up with we're working on the vision statement, and there was a lot of pressure not to include and faculty in the phrase, because it's snappier to say students transform, campus renewed, world changes develop, right? But the point is, and one of the arguments was, well, campuses renewed includes faculty, therefore we don't have to say it. True. But I think if we're going to make an impact on these campuses, if God's going to have, it's going to be students and faculty. It really has to be faculty. So let me just give you a couple of things that are happening with the strategic plan of faculty ministries. There are two main foci. The first is to reach current faculty. And I hope, what was really interesting was a staff conference and I mentioned Michigan. Remember I mentioned 60 faculty were meeting weekly and praying. There was kind of a buzz in the room. No one knew. I mean, there was a sense of, wow, that's really going on. I had to take out a story about the Air Force Academy, where at one point there were over 100 faculty meeting weekly. And it's still a very strong fellowship there. But the impact on that institution and on the cadets is quite strong. It's our plan and prayer in the next 5 years to double the number of faculty campus or witnessing communities we have from 25 to 50. That's pretty bold. We also want to run more conferences so that faculty can think. Often what happens, faculty have PhD knowledge in their field and sort of sophomore and high school level of theology, right? I mean, and so the idea is to try to help them think about both and bring them together. So greater integration. Jeff Harden, who some of you know, I go to church with him at Blackhawk. He's a professor of embryology at the University of Wisconsin here. And when he starts out his 101 course with freshmen, a big lecture hall, he says, now we're going to look at embryo, you know, we're going to look at the birth process. And he said, let me start this quarter, or this semester, with a quote from a Jewish poet. And he reads, I was fearfully and wonderfully made in my mother's womb. And that's a cue to the Christians to know that he's, you know, they can talk with him. It's also an opening up a wider conversation. So Jeff is kind of the poster child of the type of faculty member that we want to see and encourage. Did you know that every summer, recent years, there's been a faculty conference a week up at Cedar campus, and they bring their families? And did you know that this December we have Following Christ 2008, where we are hoping to have between 1,000 and 1,500 faculty and grad students come? This is a big deal. This is really a big deal. If we want to, you know, raise up these ancient ruins, it's these people are critical to that. The second way in which we want to really impact the campus through our faculty strategy, at least, is to broker future faculty coming on. And in the next couple decades, 2/3 of all faculty will retire. Well, of course, they don't have to retire. There's no retirement age, but theoretically, they will retire. And we have something called the Emerging Scholars Network, which probably most of you have heard something about. But the basic thrust of it is, what if we were to identify promising undergraduate students and promising graduate students who wanted to have their calling or felt their calling to be in the secular university? And what if in 10, 20 years, 20% of the professorate were really, really believing Christians? What difference would that make on the ancient ruins? How would that impact? So we're encouraging these young scholars, and we're also providing mentors for them. I was thrilled at staff conference when Ken Elzinga, the professor from the University of Virginia, talked about himself. Let me tell you the rest of the story. When Ken went off the board a few years back, he brought us Ellen Whitener. And Ellen was a young faculty member at the University of Virginia in the School of Business. And she progressed up through the ranks and became the associate dean. Ellen became a Christian right before she went to college, I think it was Michigan State, and got very involved with InterVarsity, was at Cedar campus for years, and tragically, when she died at age 47 of meningitis, just very quick. I remember being at her funeral, and this ties back into the Thomas Jefferson comment I made earlier. Here we are at the University of Virginia, the home of separation of church and state. We're meeting for Ellen Whitener's funeral. I hadn't thought I'd get emotional. Ellen was going to be chair of the board the next year, so we were really quite close. And I heard, you hear the standard talk by the pastor, and then student after student and faculty member got up and talked about her. And this is at the University of Virginia, and these were not Christians. These were people who had been deeply touched by her life. And it was kind of like, you know, in Thomas Jefferson's shrine, there's worship of God going on today. So, As we think and we pray, I hope this is an ongoing conversation that we continue to have. What does it mean to renew campuses? And what is our role with all of these pieces in this portfolio? of how we can impact the campus. You know, students come and go in 2, 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6 years. I mean, they move through. But there's an institution, there's a community of learners that goes on and on and on. And we really want to, our vision is to really impact those communities. Can I have a couple of people pray, volunteers, just anybody? Just raise your hand.